Of course, I don't think they do that anymore.
Well, you were pretty sick. You were probably in intensive care.
No, I wasn't. I was on the porch in the hospital, the second floor.
Oh, it's changed, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, there was no extensive care then. But nobody wanted to touch me until I began to come around. And then finally I got washed, cleaned up. But boy, did I feel filthy.
Well, I'm glad that you survived that. You seem to be doing very well. After that, though, you you had your own garage.
Well, I had. See, after I had the heart attack, being mechanically inclined most of my life, I went up because I knew Gordon Plummer and hung around his garage up there where the Wilkins Dairy was up on Proctor Place. And we hung around there, and pretty soon he said one day, "Why don't you start up the small engine business?" I says, "Well, I don't know." So he says, okay, he says. So I didn't know. He went over and put an ad in the paper, and I started getting Briggs and Stratton engines and things in and to fix, and I'd fix them, and finally I got to all authorized dealerships for parts and service, and then I got going, and I took over half the building. And then Wolcott come along and bought that building out after 10 years.
Now, is this where Wolcott's dairy was?
That's
where
right.
The present Medina dairy is?
Yeah.
I see.
And Gordon had to move, and I had to move, so Gordon went up in the, it was the Iroquois Hotel. It was a gas station out in front there in the, what is now a super duper parking lot.
Oh, yes.
And he went in there to run his garage, and I came down here and opened my own garage.
Down here on Maple Avenue.
That's
yes.
Right. And opened my own business, and I run another 10 years here.
Now, you you repaired lawnmowers and sharpened them. I remember we brought a lawnmower here once. You did a very good job. Did you also handle golf carts?
Well, I did, yes. I did a few. I didn't like that, though. It was too bulky to handle.
Mm-hmm.
So I just stuck to the stuff that was more in my line. But
Did you sell golf carts, too?
I sold the Toro lawnmower.
The lawnmower?
Yeah. I sold a lot of Toro lawnmowers. Yes. The closest one was Johnson's Creek or Knowlesville.
I see.
I was the one in between. And I sold Brake Shoe lawnmower, an $1,100 lawnmower.
Okay.
I done all my dealing on that with heating equipment out of Hamburg.
I see. In 1950, you and your wife moved down here to your present homestead. This house has been in the family for a long time, hasn't it?
That's right. It's been in well over 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because her father's father lived here, her father, and she was born here.
Mm-hmm. By she, you mean your wife?
My wife, yeah, mm-hmm. Helen. And
now, her father's name was James Gray?
Yeah, James Gray.
And who was the father before him? Who was
Henry.
It? Ed?
Henry.
Henry.
His
yeah.
father, yes. Yeah.
Henry Gray.
Henry Gray.
Okay. But this, do I understand that, Wes, that you refused to move into this house until they had done what?
Well, we had to build a bathroom.
Didn't they have a bathroom here?
No.
What did they have?
Just one of those old chick sales.
One of those buildings out in Bay?
That's right. There wasn't nothing else but in the whole neighborhood.
Yes. And now it's all very modern?
Well, it's as modern as you can make it yourself by putting in your own systems.
Yes. That's beautiful. You've seen lots of changes in this whole area. Do I understand that some of your ancestors worked on the development of Glenwood Lake?
Yes, they did. I had an Uncle Bob. He was timekeeper for the job.
What was his name, Bob?
Robert Martin.
Martin?
Yeah.
Okay.
And his mother was a cook.
What was her name?
I don't think I can tell you.
Okay, okay. She was the cook for...
Well, anyways, it was Martin, but her first name, I don't know.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, they worked down here in on the dam, Glenwood Lake, and they told me about having to, well, in the, what they call, to me, Campanis Hill, which had a couple of names before that, a different... names, which I don't remember, that they had these two-wheel scoops drawn by horses, and that's a man-made lake, and they scooped that out, went up on the hill, dumped the scoop, tipped it back, and went down, scraped up some more, and brought it up. Every once in a while, a horse would break a lake, and they shot it where it was, and covered it up with
curtains
in that hill.
Why did they build the lake over there?
Well, for power, for Sweat's Dam. Mm-hmm. They, see, Sweat had an electric company of his own, and he built that to get the generators. Mm-hmm. And they were along that, between the canal, and which is now the dam, there was three generators located. Mm-hmm. And Sweat went as far as Middleport with electricity, mm-hmm. which when we had the bakery, we had the Middleport Electric Company and the Sweat Electric Company, so that when the power went off on one, we switched to the other.
You said that, was it your aunt that did the cooking?
Well, no, it was, you see, Uncle Bob, as I called him, mm-hmm. was married my Aunt Frances.
Frances, there
yeah.
you are.
And his mother was the one that done the cooking.
Oh, I see. Well, now, who would she cook for? The workers?
The workers, yeah.
And who were the workers? Were they people from around here? Or
well,
were they
it was just like a railroad crew or something else. That they had a camp over there and a place they cooked and fed them and everything.
Hmm.
And they, well, it's about... all I can tell you about that.
How long did it take, approximately?
I haven't the slightest idea, because all I knew is that he come down here once and told me that, he says, gee, right over here on the Glenwood Lake, he says, we helped. I worked down there as timekeeper. My mother was a cook.
Uh-huh.
And that's the first time I knew anything about him being
Glenwood
here.
Lake used anything at all, other than to back up the cemetery?
No, they have they just put in another generator over there on the spillway.
Mm-hmm.
They had one, now they got two.
That's not Sweats anymore, is it?
No, that's Naga Mohawk.
Uh-huh. Wes, you belong to several organizations, or have in the past?
Yes. The Moose, I was in there. Well, everybody thought I was a charter member, but I wasn't. Then I belonged to Masons.
Do you have a degree in the Masonic Order?
No, I never tried, because it would make too much. Well, the way I looked at it, your wife, if you draw in the office, has a lot of work to do, and
yes.
She didn't have time to do it, so I just laid low.
Well, Helen, you're here and being very good and not interrupting or anything, but you're sitting here, and I'm thinking of all the years that you have worked at the Newell Shirt Factory. How many years did you work, or have you worked there?
I went there in 22, and got through in 72.
That's just 50 years.
That's right.
Did you see lots of changes?
Oh, yes, so many people, you know, come for just a few years and go, but oh, we had a lot of fun together up there.
Have the working conditions changed at all?
Well, yes. I started for $8 a week.
Yes.
And we worked from 7 until 5.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes on Saturdays.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I worked for about 3 or 4 months for $8, and I thought that's just too little.
Mm-hmm.
So then I got a raise, but it was just like pulling teeth to get a raise.
Well, what did you do? Were you working at a sewing machine or what?
Well, they started me out on a sewing machine sewing, but I had no aptitude for that at all. And then they put me on the button machine, sewing on buttons by machine. And the buttonhole machine. And the first day I started on the button machine, I broke a whole box of needles. Every button I tried to sew on, I broke a needle. And I couldn't understand it until the girl that had been running it came in and she said, "Oh, I forgot to change the machine from 4-hole buttons to 2-hole buttons." And I was trying to sew 2-hole buttons, but and the machine was set for 4-hole buttons. So after that, I got along real well, and I just loved my work.
Did you always then work on buttons?
I made buttonholes and sewed on buttons.
Mm-hmm.
And
is the material very nice, isn't it?
Oh yes, my husband has got some shirts in there that he's must have had for 20 or so on years, and they're still just as good as they were
the day that we had. Good enough to keep going.
Well. It has changed hands, of course, now,
mm-hmm.
You know.
Who owns it now?
Oh, dear, if I can think of his name.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think
of it. It's out of the Newells?
Yes, it's out of their hands.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Kuhn,
mm-hmm.
And his wife, of course, he was the owner after his mother died.
Mm-hmm.
And he sold it to these people now, and I can't think of their name.
Mm-hmm.
You
mm-hmm.
know, when I came out, they were just coming.
But
in
you had employment all through the Depression then?
Did I what?
Did you have employment
through the Depression? Oh, yes, I worked all the time.
Mm-hmm. You were very fortunate.
Uh-huh. And, of course, then as I got older, I only worked part-time and like
yes.
that, just when they needed me
yes.
and like that. But
They probably changed their wages and
oh,
their
yes.
time schedule.
Of course, they had to.
Yes.
You know, with when they said they had to pay $3 an hour. Why?
Mm-hmm.
I imagine it's up there now, more than that.
About how many people does Newell's Shirt Factory employ
now?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I wouldn't know.
When you last worked there?
Oh, I would think there was about 75.
75.
I
Are they mostly women?
Well, yes, they were mostly women, and then some of the men worked in the laundry, and then the cutting room.
Mm-hmm.
And Ollie Holland, she worked in the cutting room. She was there, she was a draft lady.
Mm-hmm.
And she is now about 90-some-odd years old, she's still alive.
Is that right?
And Edna McKnight.
Yes.
And Alice Babb.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've made a lot of friends too.
Oh, heavens,
yes. Yes. Do you have a group that get together?
No, not right now, but we did for a while there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard as when everybody is one is married, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them are married women,
mm-hmm.
And it's hard to get anybody to like that anymore.
Both of you very much for this interview. We really appreciate it, Wes and Helen. This is tape 2, a continuation with an interview with Mr. Wesley Heights of one of Maple Avenue in Medina, New York. Mr. Heights, you were telling me a little bit about being young and carefree in the time of Prohibition.
That's right. You had been living where?
Middleport.
Mm-hmm.
And then I used to go with girls to Lockport. And on the way to Lockport, I had stopped to this, what they call the Cottage Inn, or run by Josie, I can't think of her last name.
Mm-hmm.
And of course you get acquainted and you get a glass of home brew here, and then you go to Lockport, and on the way back you get one on the way home, and after a while you got well known, they'd approach you, well, I got some stuff I want to pick up on the River Road.
Mm-hmm. Now the River Road was whereabouts was that near?
Well, in the vicinity of 555 River Road, Tonawanda, up through that way.
I see.
And where it came from, it come up, seemed like it come up from the bank, but I never seen, because they brought it up, put it in the car, and they drove away.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean, came up from the bank?
Well, Niagara River Bank.
I see.
And
how was it, whatever you got, how was it packaged?
Well, it was packaged, of course it was bottled, and it was put in and tied up so many bottles to a burlap that they made up, maybe 8 bottles or 10 bottles. It wasn't a 12-bottle case.
Mm-hmm.
It was the way they could make a burlap package so they could handle it. And they'd bring that in and put it in the car, and you never touched it.
Did the bottles rattle?
No, it was tight enough so that they didn't make any noise. Well, they had straw in between them.
I see.
Inside of that, and it was all wrapped and sewed. And it didn't make any noise, but after they give you this stuff and then say, okay, go ahead, and you had an envelope in your pocket, you handed it to them, that must have been a check or money or whatever it was.
Now this person, Josie, perhaps would have told you to go to a certain place?
Yeah.
And she would have given you the money or the check, the envelope?
Yeah.
And then they would tell you to take it back to her place, is that right?
No, I knew I'd had to come back with it because she already said, here, go get this, bring it back. Then we had 2 or 3 times when I needed some money, got about $80 a trip. And used her car, and the last time trip I made coming back to her place, revenue, as you might call them, took after me out of Lewiston. And of course I had this Hudson sedan, so it was a coupe with the driver's seat all alone, the tip-up seat in the front, and then a seat along the back and probably carry about 5 people. Well, that was loaded right up to the top practically. And as I got down out of Lewiston, they took 2 or 3 shots at me. Well, that scared me pretty bad. So I took off. But when I got...
You mean you went faster in the car?
Oh, yes. I took off then. I wasn't fooling. I was just keeping ahead of them before. Then after they shot at me, I wanted to get away from them. So I took off, and I went down, and I pulled, and right beside that place was like a lane went down into the back country there, and there was a dirt road across there, which eventually wound up to be another shortcut to Lockport. And I drove down there, all the way down through, I was pushing those burlap bag things out of the car.
Dumping them out as you went along?
As I went along, grabbed one, throw it out the door, and throw another one. And I got down the road and turned to come up. And I was empty, so I come back up, the road out of Gasport, and up to the center road, and then back to her place, and drove in, and they were still there looking around. Well, I come in from the other direction, and they were trying to find the car. Well, they found the car, but they didn't have the license because they didn't get that close to it. And they checked it all over, and I had to answer a lot of questions. Well, that was the end of that for me.
Well, what about the money that she had paid for this bootleg liquor?
Well, she got her liquor. It was all down the lot.
You mean the bottles didn't break when you threw them out?
No, they were packed in straw with the burlap and sewed tight, see?
I see.
And as you pushed them out, they just dropped onto the ground, the grass.
I see.
I went through fence and gates and everything else.
How did the
more support
on the back to keep them from dragging down when they got loaded up or not?
No, when they got loaded, they were loaded, they were dragging, just like any of them would. They, of course, the springs, they had four springs on them then, which, in my word, would be stronger than the cars today with a coil spring. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether she had this car made special for that or not, but at least I made four trips and then I got out of it.
Mm-hmm. What about during the time of Prohibition, which covered a number of years, there were quite a number of open bars, really, weren't there?
Oh, yeah, there was all kinds of places. There was down in Medina, there was Cotty Hoy. And in Middleport, there was the Mulcahy and Jim Casey. And George Fenton had a Middleport hotel. He had a place in there that you could get a beer or liquor or whatever you wanted to drink. But they had to know you, you didn't get in.
How did they know you, even if they didn't know you?
Oh, no.
Did you have a password?
Well, I'll use this for an example. Up in the corner of the transit in the Buffalo Road, there was three speakeasies. There was Kipples, there was Fink's, and I can't remember the one on the south west corner of the transit. And all those places, you can go up and rap at the door and say, if you knew somebody they knew and mentioned their name, you could get in. And I've been up to those places when I'd be over to Pete Kipples and one across the Buffalo Road on the other side would get raided, and they'd all run from there over to our place, the other place I was at. A bartender got shot up there one night, and I had this girl from Lockport, and we used to stop there, and she used to entertain. Her name was Bobby Peach. She was only a little bit of a tyke, and whenever I went in, the first thing they'd had to get her, never paid a bill then after she, when he went in with her, and she entertained them.
What do you mean, entertain them?
Well, she sang, done a few dance steps and so on. And she was well known, and she had quite a following. They all thought she was, in other words, when they had the dance hall down the Chattagy, she was down there two or three times. So. Mm-hmm.
What'd you say?
Well, you said after you met the woman who became your wife, you decided not to have anything more to do with helping this rum running at all.
I didn't. All I did is we used to sit by and watch. I didn't. I quit when I, because after all, it wouldn't have been too good to get in trouble and be going with Helen and have her.
Right.
So I said, well, heck.
Decided not to take the chances.
That's right. It was too risky.
Yes. Do you remember any anything other than small arrests? Were there any big arrests? Were the police really aware of what was going on?
Well, I think they knew everybody that was in it. There was Headley down to Alcott. He had this big boat and he run it. He used to take passengers out on it.
What was the name of that boat? Was that the Humpty Dumpty Breezy Lake Ride?
That was it. And then they'd he'd get caught with a whole boatload of counterband on it, of bootleg liquor. They'd take boat and all and arrest him. They'd take the boat either to the up by Niagara River or down by Rochester, and they'd, after so long, they'd hold an auction. Well, he'd send somebody down to bid on it and get it right back again. It's just one of those things that went round and round. Yeah, it's...
That was a good-sized boat, wasn't it?
That used to hold 40, 50 passengers. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, that was a big boat. They could carry a lot of stuff on that.
Well, they didn't always have liquor on board.
Oh,
then.
No. When they used it for passenger service, it was legitimate.
Uh-huh.
But it was just a blind to cover up, because he was out on the lake all the time, and there was nothing to see the boat out there, so he'd sneak up and get a load and bring it down. And
tell me about most of the boats.
Did this rum running?
Were they pretty good size?
Well, there was some not too big. There was little guys and big guys. And mm-hmm. There was some like Headley that had boats not quite as big or a little bigger. Then there was even a Chris Craft motorboat mm-hmm. that they'd make maybe 2-3 trips in the night.
Mm. Must have been a pretty good profit in that.
They had to be. Mm-hmm. They had to be, yes. Mm-hmm.
And who went over to do this? Just people like yourself, or were there big groups or big organizations that did it?
No, I don't think there was organized any. There was just people that would want a piece of the pie, and they'd run in there and make a trip and come back. And,
mm-hmm.
and they might do it once, and they might do it 100 times.
So if they went over and got whatever they got and came back with it, who would do the unloading?
Well, a lot of them, the small guys, done their own. They'd pull in the shore and drop it off in about 18, 20 inches of water, take their boat away, and then come back and wade in and hook it out. And put it in a barn on the lake shore someplace, and then a truck would come down, and they'd load the truck, and they'd bring it up through this section.
Now, to put it in a barn means that they had to have the cooperation of that farmer.
Yes.
Were there quite a few farmers involved?
And one of them along the lake shore was in it.
Is that right?
We've sat there and watched them night after night come in. And
How did the boats know where to come in the dark?
Well, they had signals for them. They had different signals that they used. They'd some had flashlights, some had lanterns. And one barn I know had hung a lantern up in the hay mow in the unloading doors that swung open to bring the hay in. That lantern, one lantern hang there, and if the revenue showed up, they'd be a couple lanterns in there, and they wouldn't come in.
Well,
it was a lot of fun, and all that, as long as you didn't get caught, but I imagine you could have got yourself in the trouble.
When the stuff then was loaded, now somebody else had to have a truck to come down and pick it up, is that right? Or
well,
a big car?
It had to be transported from place to place,
mm-hmm.
from different ones.
Mm-hmm.
No, they
would they just have one car or truck taking the bootleg liquor wherever? Well, or were
no,
there...
they didn't deliver like so many here and so many there. The one guy would bring in, well, we'll say 50 cases. And he'd take care of it. One way or another, if he had to take it out five at a time to this place and that place and the next place. It wasn't organized enough to have a distributing
mm-hmm.
situation. Mm-hmm. Oh, that was a good old day.
What kind of bootleg liquor was there? Was it all one kind?
Oh, no. They had all kinds. They had scotch. You see, the Canada would get it from England and Ireland. They had Irish whiskey and scotch and all this different brands. And then they had bathtub gin they used to make themselves.
Now, what's bathtub gin?
Well, alcohol, distilled water, and juniper berries. They used to make that and bottle it and sell it for gin. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they'd, in them days they called They made a drink, they called it the orange blossom. Oh, it was only gin and orange juice.
Hmm.
And they mean, most any place had that, it was all.
You know, what about wine? Was wine illegal too?
Why, I don't know. There was never, the only wine was some guy had a vineyard and he made his own wine. Mm-hmm. Like Charlie Capanna down here, he had a vineyard out here. And he made wine. And
Now, if he gave it to you, that was not illegal, was
no,
it?
That wasn't.
But if he sold it, then it was illegal.
Some people he gave it to and some people he sold it to. See, that was... He always was trying to get me loaded on that Dago Red.
That was the name of the wine?
Yeah, no sugar. It was just plain fermented grape juice. Mm-hmm. And it was red, and boy, did it have a kick to it.
Oh, really?
Oh.
Yes, another person that was interviewed talked about Dago Red wine.
Well,
as if it really did have a kick to it.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it was a lot of them. Grapes growing right out here.
Yeah.
And he had the press and the old winery out in back of the garage down there. And
now, would that be a hand press?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. He'd run it off. He'd have, 8, 10 barrels, wouldn't he? About a wine every year.
Is that right?
Yeah, and then people come by it by the gallon and so on. Once in a while, like if he could get a hold of me and get me down there and try to get me loaded, I don't know, it's just for spite, I guess.
Well, what do you mean get you loaded? You mean really
too much
you...
wine to drink, and they laugh at me when I walk out. I said to him, well, Charlie, you've had it, no more of this. I'll take one drink.
What about, talking about times of prohibition, where the women were, that was a time of bobbed hair and flappers and that sort of thing. Do you think all of this had anything to do with women getting into drinking more, or did they drink as much as they do today?
I don't know. Helen never took a drink while I was with her. I've taken her in those places.
But were there women in there drinking?
Oh, too? Yes. Oh, yes. You could find that. There was all types of women, just like today.
Sure.
There was no difference. It was the only thing that was a little more hushed up than it is today. Today it's more open.
Mm-hmm.
But... He was, all the girls I went with had bobbed hair, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember any of them taking a drink today.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I never took any of them in, only, as I said, that Kipples place up on the Buffalo Road in Transit.
Mm-hmm.
And, I took two or three girls in there.
Mm-hmm. When you went into a speakeasy, would they have... some kind of music, too, for entertainment?
Oh, yeah, they had, five-piece orchestra in most of the places. And they were all good musicians. There wasn't any fookies.
You and Helen have always enjoyed dancing?
Oh, yes, that's where, down the hall, because I met her in Jake Aldridge's dance hall.
Uh-huh.
She sat there when I walked in. And said that that's the one I wanted to dance with, and I was introduced to her. They had a five-piece orchestra there, too.
Mm-hmm.
And
what were you telling me about dancing recently, in Boston? But quite recently.
Well, he was in they called it the Suntong Restaurant. And we went in, and I says, well, let's dance. And we started to dance, and right away the orchestra picked up Young at Heart.
Uh-huh, that's a good song.
Yeah.
And then you danced?
Oh, yeah, we danced all around.
Well. Mr. Height, thinking on the prohibition part of it, can you remember any pranks that were pulled on some of these people?
Oh, yeah, my dad worked in a bakery all night there in Fenton's Hotel.
In Middleport.
And this two-door Model T Ford pulled up, and he had all this homebrew in it. And he was selling it and making deliveries. And while he was in making a delivery in the hotel, my dad unloaded it in George Fenton's head. And when he came back to his car, it was empty. And he... looked all over and couldn't find it. He come in the bakery and he wanted to know if he seen anybody steal his stuff out of his car. And my dad says no. So I let him look for a while, and then finally he told him, it's over in the hedge in Bennett's hedge next door. And that it's places all over you'd find. Like in Medina even, somebody would be, well, I met a car stuck on the road. When I got up to help him get out, it was loaded with homebrew and bootleg and stuff.
So a lot of people really were involved.
Oh, there was a lot of them involved, yeah.
I take it they really weren't, police officials really weren't crackerjacks at nailing down the people.
It was almost impossible. Mm-hmm. You take a night watchman like Medina had, Millport had night watchmen, they were walking, what could they do?
Yeah.